listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our day, and that means it is time for our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator, although the people of Vermont know he's theirs, the independent from Vermont, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, welcome back. He's not ready. He is ready. He's not ready. Oh.
I'm on the... Hello?
Hey, Bernie, yeah, I hear you now.
Okay.
Okay, great. So, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
The fiscal cliff is looming as Senator McConnell is filibustering himself. Strange things going on in the Senate.
Well, we have two separate issues. We have the fiscal cliff and we have the debt ceiling. But to some degree, they are significantly related. So let me just try to keep people informed about the issues that are going on. I think most people understand that we're in the deficit fix that we're in right now because of two unpaid wars, tax breaks for the rich, an unpaid-for Medicare Part D prescription drug program, and very importantly, a significant decline in revenue because of the Wall Street-caused recession. When people lose their jobs, millions of people lost their jobs, they're not paying taxes, revenue is going down. And in fact, they're getting food stamps, they're getting unemployment benefit. So the government is hurting as a result of that. We're in a situation now where there is an agreement that when you have a $16 trillion national debt and a $1 trillion deficit, we need deficit reduction. And obviously, what this whole fiscal cliff is about is how do you do deficit reduction? Our Republican friends, as usual, want to continue their attacks against working families, the elderly, the sick, the children, the poor. And they come up with proposals like cutting Social Security. Well, that's a pretty dumb proposal because Social Security hasn't contributed one nickel to the deficit because it's funded by the payroll tax. But they like cutting Social Security because they don't like government. They don't like government programs that work well like Social Security. And there's another brilliant idea out there that says, well, let's raise the Medicare retirement age, Medicare eligibility age, to 67 years of age. Well, what that means is there'll be a two-year gap between 65 or 67 where a whole lot of seniors who are in desperate need of health care, you start, you know, running into health care problems when you get old, are not going to have it. B, some of those folks may turn to Medicaid, which is another government program, just shifting costs. C, they may have to get private insurance, which is much more expensive for the system in general and for themselves, because Medicare is more efficient than private health insurance. But that is something that should be vigorously opposed. There's another proposal which Republicans and some Democrats have out there, called the so-called chain CPI. Now, nobody outside of the Beltway has a clue what the chain CPI is, but it's a very devious way being pushed by Pete Peterson and other billionaires out there, Wall Street billionaires, to cut programs for working families. And what that does is says that the COLAs, the cost of living adjustments, that seniors and disabled veterans are getting are too high, and we've got to cut them back. Seniors laugh at this every time I mention it because they know that in the last 2 out of 3 years, they didn't receive any cost of living adjustment at all. What this would mean if the chain CPI would go in, and that's a new way to configure inflation for seniors and disabled vets, it would mean if you're 65 today, by the time you're 75, you get $560 a year less. By the time you're 85, it's $1,000 a year less. And it will also mean very significant cuts for disabled veterans. And I cannot believe that there are very many people outside of Wall Street or the Republican Party who think it's a good idea to continue tax breaks for billionaires and cut benefits for disabled vets. The chain CPI approach would also result in a tax increase for low-income working people by making cuts in the earned income tax credit and the refundable child tax credit. So it's a very devious effort to cut programs and raise taxes for low-income working people, veterans, and seniors. And it's something we will vigorously oppose. The bottom line here, Tom, is historically, the Republicans have shown themselves to be a lot tougher than the Democrats are. In 2010, despite the Democrats having some 58 or 59 senators and controlling the House of Representatives and controlling the White House, they made huge concessions to the Republicans, and they did that again in 2011. And I hope very much, frankly, I think the president is doing better now. He appears to be standing tough. But I hope the Democrats look at this election and look at every poll that's out there, which says that, yes, we should do deficit reduction, but we should not, we should do it in a way that asks the wealthy and large corporations to stop paying their fair share, take a hard look at military spending, but do not cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, and other important programs. And if the Democrats hold firm on this issue and reflect what the overwhelming majority of the American people want, what will end up happening is the right thing in terms of a budget agreement, and I think the American people will feel pretty good about it.
Bernie, is the cut that would happen to disabled veterans if they put into place this chain CPI, which will over time cut benefits to Social Security recipients, is that because disabled veterans are receiving some of their benefits via Social Security, or is it
tough?
How does that work?
And then that's the short answer, yes.
Okay.
According to, I'm just reading you some information. According to the Social Security Administration, permanently disabled veterans who started receiving VA disability benefits at age 30 would see their benefits cut by more than $1,300 a year at age 45, $1,800 a year at age 55, and $2,200 a year at age 65.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, this is something that most people don't know about.
Yeah.
But what you got is the Wall Street billionaires and our Republican friends trying to obfuscate the issue. They get on television and say, we want entitlement reform. When you hear anyone say they want entitlement reform, what they're talking about is cuts in Social Security, cuts in Medicare, and cuts in benefits for disabled veterans.
Yeah.
So we have to make them speak English and be honest about what they want to do. And when people hear what they want to do, we're going to stop them.
Yeah, and that disabled veterans part, that, you know, if the tables were turned, if the Democrats are trying to do this and the Republicans were yelling, they would be yelling so loud.
The uproar that Rush Limbaugh and Fox Television would be having?
Oh, yeah. It would be incredible. So we have Mitch McConnell filibustering himself. What are your thoughts? You've talked before about filibuster reform. How do you think this is going to play out?
Well, I don't know how it's going to play out. We're working hard on it. Here's the story. And a lot of people, you know, the Senate is a very complicated institution, much too complicated. But it has all kinds of rules which make no sense to ordinary people. And they shouldn't, because they are not sensible. But among other things, you know, individual senators can put a hold, can say a bill is coming up, and they say, well, I'm going to put a hold on that bill. I want to filibuster this bill. And you don't have to go down on the floor and do anything. You have to threaten that, and that means that you need, the majority needs what's called a cloture vote to get 60 votes to continue the debate. You can have a cloture vote on whether or not to even proceed to the matter at hand. So the question is, should we consider a bill to do A, B, and C? You can even cloture that, let alone cloture the bill itself. So the result of it is that since Obama has been president, Republicans have done this a whole lot. The Senate is largely dysfunctional. We have to change it. We need filibuster reform.
Yeah, amen. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. 15 minutes past, and bernie.org. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, over at tomhartman.com, we have our iPhone app and our new story. You can click on the link at the top of the page. 15 minutes. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. David in Greenbelt, Maryland, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, a pleasure to speak to you once again. question. Republicans insist that we have a spending problem, but from 1946 for 36 years, our top marginal tax rate was 91% and 70%. 36 years. My first question is, why does no Democrat reply with facts that we have a revenues collection problem, not a spending problem, and that taxes have never been so low? My second question is, has anyone ever done a study to determine exactly how much revenue was lost due to the low tax policies of Reagan, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama?
Well, the first point, David, is you're right. That point is not made enough, but some of us do make it very often. At the beginning of the show, I made that point. And here's what David is saying. While our Republican friends say, oh, the problem is that we're just spending, and we are spending, in the midst of this recession, a significant amount of money, what they forget to tell us is that revenue today as a percentage of GDP is somewhere around 15.6%, which is the lowest that it has been in 60 years. So if revenue were coming in at 21% of GDP, because we hadn't give tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and the largest corporations, our deficit situation would be in a very, very different place. So the issue is not such a spending issue. As David indicates, it is a revenue issue as well. What we do know is that the effective tax rates for the very wealthy are, as Warren Buffett often reminds us, very, very low. And that's why Mitt Romney, who's worth a couple of $100 million, chose not to release many of his tax returns. That's why. Because he would be embarrassed to show that his income tax rate was lower than that of teachers or firemen or cops or middle-class workers. The second point is, today as a percentage of revenue, corporate taxes are also extremely low. And what we know is that one out of four profitable corporations in America today doesn't pay a nickel in taxes. We know that we're losing about $100 billion every year from companies and individuals who stash their money in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens. So David's point is a very important point. You're right, David, not enough people talk about it, but some of us do.
Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, how you doing, Senator? It's a great honor to talk to you.
Thanks.
I want to get your opinion on this idiotic Republican talking point that we always hear, that tax cuts for multimillionaires stimulates the economy. I have a degree in economics, and my dad was a college professor of economics, and I know that that's the opposite of the truth. The only way to stimulate the economy is to raise taxes on multimillionaires, and the government uses that money to put people to work building bridges, roads, schools, hiring people, to protect our food supply so we don't die from eating peanut butter or getting a steroid shot, you know, things like that.
Well, Paul, I think you're right. You're exactly right. Look, what we are seeing and have seen for many years now, and I use this expression advisedly, is class warfare being waged by billionaires and the very wealthiest people in large corporations against working families. And we're seeing that in a number of ways. I mean, just in this last election, we had dozens of billionaires contributing huge amounts of money trying to defeat Obama and progressive Democrats. We have seen Wall Street and billionaires lobby like crazy to gain loopholes for themselves. They are able and they effectively can put their money in tax havens abroad. They have shut down plants in America that were profitable, and they moved them to China. They have waged unrelentless war against unions and working families. That's what is going on right now. And they have to come up with some theory, ideology, which makes it sound like what they're doing makes sense, and that's called trickle-down economics. So they come up with this, what George Bush the First called voodoo economics, and that somehow if you give tax breaks to billionaires and if you give tax breaks to large corporations, magically they are going to create jobs in the United States of America. Well, the record is very clear. We did that under Bush, George W. Bush. It was a disaster. his economic job, his job creation record was an absolute disaster. Paul makes the better point, the right point, that if you put money into working people's hands, if you make sure that our people have jobs, that you don't cut things like unemployment benefits, that when people, working people have money, they're going to spend that money locally. They have to buy food. They have to buy furniture. They have to buy clothing for their kids. They put gas in the car and so forth and so on. And that is the way you create jobs, not by giving tax breaks to rich people through trickle-down economics.
Deborah in Oklahoma City. We just have a minute to the break. Deborah, a quick question?
Yes, I was wondering about the establishing of a National Election Commission that's nonpartisan that draws the district line so that we get away from all of this gerrymandering, and whether or not I know that, like, Australia does that and some other countries, and if we could maybe think about that here.
Well, Deborah, I think it's a good point, and I think we really need gerrymandering. It is a real issue. And we have seen some, I mean, it's not a new idea. It's been going on for a few hundred years. And it's been used by both, you know, all political parties. But I think it's becoming a little bit extreme lately. I think it's, Deborah, if I can say so, it's not just gerrymandering. We have to take a hard look at why it is, that it takes people in Florida 7, 8, 9 hours to cast their ballots, and other abuses that take place within our election system. So I think we do need to take a hard look at a lot of those election issues.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our National Town Hall Meeting Hour, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders will be back with more answers to your questions right after this break. Check out his website. His website is sanders.senate.gov. He has a great newsletter. He's got a lot of good news information.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop into our free live chat room over at tomhartman.com. Hang out with some of the finest minds on earth. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls for this hour and our national town hall meeting. Bernie, a quick question before we move along. I just got a copy from a friend who owns one of the stations that we're on, of a letter that you and nine others, or you and nine, I guess nine senators altogether, sent to Julius Genachowski. How is about media consolidation and this gift that they may be giving to Rupert Murdoch? How's that going?
Well, it's not just Rupert Murdoch. It's a gift that they may be giving to the large media conglomerates in this country. I think, Tom, many of the listeners are aware that in our country today you have a handful of giant media conglomerates, companies like General Electric, Murdoch's News Corp, Disney, Viacom, Time Warner, and CBS. They control about 90% of the media in America. You know, people think that they go to a magazine place and they're looking at many magazines. By and large, they're owned by a few companies. You turn on your cable television, you think you got dozens and dozens of stations, separate stations, independent stations. They're, by and large, owned by a few companies. Now, what happens is what the FCC said a number of years ago is that in a democracy, I'm paraphrasing, it's important that people get a diverse point of view, that they hear from different perspectives. And you can't do that when you have just a few companies controlling what people in a given community are going to receive in terms of television, radio, and newspaper information. What the FCC...
Oh. Okay.
Those rules allow for more media consolidation such that...
Bernie, if you can hear me...
One company, whether it's Murdoch's company or any other, could own significant amounts of media, television stations, radio stations, newspaper in a given community, and really control the flow of information. They are back to trying to do that, and some of us are trying to stop them.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much for clearing that up for me. Let's see here. Jimmy in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. Am I saying that right, Jimmy?
Yeah, you got it right.
You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, the question I have is about Medicaid and the Medicaid expansion that that some of the states are going to reject, like Texas. Will those poor citizens of the states like that be able to take part in the exchanges and get fully subsidized?
Jimmy, you've asked a very, very important question. I think, Tom, we're having some problems here again.
Yeah, are we picking Bernie up through the phone or through the Comrex? We're on the Comrex, yeah, so you can just talk into the microphone, Bernie.
Right.
I think it's working.
Okay. Jimmy asked a very profound question, in that one of the important parts of so-called Obamacare, as Jimmy indicates, was to expand health insurance coverage to about 30 million Americans, primarily lower-income people who have no health insurance at all. And you do that through the expansion of Medicaid. And now you have governors in various states in the country saying, we don't want it. We don't want it, even though in the first years the federal government is going to be paying 100% of the cost, and then in later years a significant part of the cost, not all of it. And to answer Jimmy's question, it is an absolute tragedy. And in Texas, actually, I think it's where the problem is most acute. You got a whole lot of folks in Texas who have no health insurance at all. And this Affordable Care Act, this expansion of Medicaid, would be a huge boon. Very, very important for a whole lot of folks in Texas. So all I can say to you, Jimmy, I don't know the answer to what happens to those people. But what I would hope the people of Texas do is organize and say, excuse me, we want our kids. We want our parents. We want to be able to go to the doctor when we are sick. We don't want to die prematurely because we don't have health insurance. So I think the goal should be in Texas and elsewhere is to start putting pressure on the governors and the legislatures to make sure that they do what the federal government now is allowing them to do, and that is to provide health care coverage for a significant number of people who otherwise would be without it.
Matt, in Oakland Gardens, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I had a question. National Nurses United, they're holding protests, I believe, on Monday to try to push for a Wall Street sales tax, to try and, a financial transactions tax. I'm wondering if Senator Sanders, would you support that? Because I know you did in the past.
Yes, I have, I do, I will. I think it's a very significant step forward, and we're working with folks like Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, Senator Tom Harkin. We have a version we put in to our dental bill. We greatly expanded dental coverage, and one of the ways we pay for it is by a transaction fee on Wall Street. And we think it also, not only can it raise substantial sums of money, and by the way, Europe is looking at this, it can also put a damper on Wall Street speculation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see here. Laurel in Adrian, Minnesota. Laurel, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Bernie. Yeah, Tom, too. Thanks for taking my call. For the past 20 years, virtually my entire life, I've worked with individuals with special needs. I've seen firsthand the improvements in the lives of so many people the American Disabilities Act has given to these people. And to learn this week that the Senate actually turned down or defeated this UN treaty to, you know, basically bring the ADA worldwide, I just find that so dispiriting and disheartening. I was wondering what your take on that was, knowing that 38 senators voted against this. This measure passed 20 years ago with bipartisan support. I know for a fact there are senators that were there 20 years ago that were voting for the ADA that turned it down now. It's just, I don't understand the motivation behind that.
Well, I'll tell you what it is about, Laurel. Thanks very much. And that was kind of a shocking occurrence. And if my memory is correct, if my understanding is correct, Bob Dole, Senator Bob Dole, who everybody knows ran for president, was a Republican leader for many, many years, and Bob suffered very serious injuries in World War II, which caused problems with one of his hands. And Senator Dole was on the floor, as I understand it, during this vote. He is a strong supporter of this convention. The very first speech, as I understand it, that Dole gave way back when he first came to the Senate, was talking about disabilities. Obviously, as a wounded veteran, he understood what disabilities were about. So we had his very strong support. I think all of the Democrats voted for it. Some Republicans voted for it. We got over 60 votes, but you need 67 votes to pass the treaty. And I think the extreme right wing went to work with their right wing base. I think, amazingly enough, they somehow made this into an abortion issue. I can't explain it to you because it's beyond my comprehension. But I think it was a sad day that this treaty was defeated.
Okay. Ed, in Moundsville, West Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator, the first time I've ever got a chance to talk to you. I was just wondering why we can't somehow put a stop to these Republicans getting by with all this money, hush money and everything, and also too, why if the Republicans want to not have this stuff, then okay, let's split it and let the Democrats have what they want and the Republicans have what they want. I mean, if they want to be so, and then their people would find out what it's really all about. I was talking to my doctor yesterday, a brilliant man, and he totally doesn't know anything about free speech or these TV programs, and I think something needs to be done to get this out to people so that they'll understand what's really going on.
Well, Ed, thanks very much for the call. You know, Tom and I just a moment ago, Tom asked me about some work we're doing regarding the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, in which we're trying to prevent these large media conglomerates from buying up more and more of media in America. And I think that Ed's point is that a lot of people don't know what's going on in government. They don't know what's going on in their society. I'll give you an example. Tom, I don't know if you saw this. There was a poll done recently in which something like, I think the number was 49% of Republicans think that Obama won this election because he stole it as a result of the work of Acorn.
Right, which hasn't existed for 2 years. Yeah, I saw that.
All right. You know, so you stop and you scratch your head and you say, here's an organization that doesn't even exist. And half of the Republicans think the election was stolen as a result of a work for an organization that doesn't exist. So you're wondering what world these folks are living in. Where are they getting their information? Every night there's going to be somebody getting on television and saying, Social Security, as we all know, Social Security is going broke. Well, we all don't know that Social Security is going broke because Social Security is not going broke. But that's common knowledge that keeps getting said over and over again that happens not to be true.
Very, very well said. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Your opportunity to talk to a United States Senator and in our national town hall meeting here every Friday. It's Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this. This show is sponsored in part by the Tom Hartman Store, with T-shirts and mugs and bags. Oh, my! All that and more at TomHartman.com. Click Store. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, and Mark in Eugene, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Senator. I'm calling about the upcoming physical cliff and the Postal Service being tied to that bill, or a bill about the Postal Service being tied to the physical cliff. What I mean is the life of the post office is in danger, Saturday delivery and such.
Hang on just a second, Mark. I got to get Bernie on the phone here.
You hear me?
Yeah, Bernie, I hear you fine now.
Right,
on the telephone.
Don't know what's going on here. We seem to be having some problems.
Yeah, I think we have a flaky line for the Comrex today. So okay. Anyhow, he was asking about the post office.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. It's an issue. He raises a very important issue. It's one that I've worked very hard on. Where we are right now is the Senate passed a bill, bipartisan bill. Wasn't great. Wasn't as much as I wanted, but was reasonably good. And it protected rural post offices. It protected Saturday mail. It protected the distribution centers all over this country that the Postmaster General had originally wanted to make really significant cuts in. We believe there are ways to strengthen the Postal Service by bringing in more revenue rather than just decimating it. What's going on right now, what I can tell you, is there are discussions going on between the House and the Senate. The House has not passed anything. But the chairman of the relevant committee there really wants to decimate and ultimately privatize the Postal Service. So there are debates. There are negotiations going on now. And I hope this week to find out the status of these things. They make me nervous. The main point, people don't necessarily know this, the main reason for the Postal Service's financial problems have to do with the fact that in 2006, Congress mandated that they pay $5 billion a year into future health retiree benefits, an amount of money that nobody else in America has paid. And, in fact, they pretty much covered the account. They don't need to put more in there. And in the Senate bill, we ended that. That's $5 billion a year that the Postal Service could save. So it is an issue that concerns me very much. We've worked on. I'll find out more about the status of these negotiations probably next week.
Audrey in Richton Park, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. My question is this. Currently the gluttonous members among the wealthy, they're allowed to play these semantic games and call themselves job creators. Who will put them in their place to remind them that they are business owners who must hire people in order to keep up with the demand for their products or services? You know, these guys are employers who without their employees would not be able to properly supply the demand for what they sell and would not be able to prosper, therefore, if their companies fail to keep up with the demand for their products and services.
Well, Audrey, thank you very much. I think you've made a very, very important point. These guys cannot produce their products or provide their services without workers. And they don't make any money unless people purchase the products that they produce. And I get a little bit tired of some of these guys thinking they're God's gift to the human race as they shut down plants in America and move to China, as they stash their profits in the Cayman Islands and not pay their fair share of taxes to the United States, as they try to destroy unions who are organizing workers. So I think Audrey's point is very, very important, and that is that we understand that these guys don't make any money without the people who produce the products and services and people who purchase their products.
Robert in Mission Viejo, California. We just have 2 minutes to the end of the show, Rob, or to the end of this hour, Robert. A quick question?
Not a problem. You know, it's my theory that in order to create real change, you have to create space for that change. So my question is, Senator, can you think of one measure by which America and probably the world wouldn't be better off without the Republican Party?
Well, I'll tell you what I do think, Robert, in seriousness. If you understand that in this last election, the Republicans had huge support from billionaires, that their friends own the media, that they control 90% of talk radio, that there are parts of this country where working families don't hear one progressive idea on the radio or local television or local newspapers. Add all that together and they still lose an election. It just goes to show you how far out of touch their ideology is with what the American people want. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. In my view, there is no state in America, not the reddest of the red states, where people believe that we should give tax breaks to billionaires and then cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and programs for kids. I don't think there is a state in the union where people believe that, and that is exactly what the Republican Party wants to do. So I think our job is to educate, to organize. I think we need a 50-state strategy, which takes progressive ideas into red states where right now they are unchallenged. And if we do that, I think we can create a permanent progressive movement in this country, which will make government respond to the needs of working families and not just millionaires and billionaires.
It seems like there's about two square blocks here in D.C. and a couple of square blocks in Wall Street where they do think that.
That's right, Tom, and that is the truth. And what happens is they come up with an idea, and because they have zillions of dollars behind those ideas, you just saw the Heritage Foundation just hired my good friend, my colleague Jim DeMint, who is extreme right-wing guy.
Yeah.
The Heritage Foundation is going to be funded by corporate America, as is the Cato Institute and all these right-wing think tanks. They got the money, and they own a good part of the media. And we just have to educate and organize and fight for our progressive principles.
Amen. And thanks so much for fighting so hard for all of us all these years and for the great work that you're continuing to do. Senator Bernie Sanders, thank you.
Good. Thank you, Tom. Take care.
Always a pleasure having you with us. We will be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. And we're going to have a special guest who's taking on a giant corporation at a very young age. Stick around to find it faster.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. And Sam Sachs is in the studio with us today. Sam and I have been writing together pieces, our daily take pieces, for truthout.org for some time and other efforts, collaborative efforts. He also helps produce The Big Picture, our TV program on the evening. That's in the evening. It's on Free Speech TV and RT and a couple hundred cable systems around the country and whatnot. Sam, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you with us.
Yeah, in person. Not on Skype.
Yeah, in person and not on Skype. Absolutely. And you're just going to hang out with me here for this hour, and we're going to take calls. It's Anything Goes Friday. But before we get into your calls and our Anything Goes Friday stuff, I want to pose this question, and I'd like to get your take on it, Sam, and then we'll toss it out. And if our listeners and viewers, if you have thoughts on it, I would love to hear them. Senator Jim DeMint just left the United States Senate, which used to be considered next to the president, the most powerful job in the world, being a senator, just left the United States Senate for $1 million-a-year job as the CEO of the Heritage Foundation, this right-wing think tank that was originally founded and funded in part by the Koch brothers, still is, and as far as I know, and, that looks out for the interests of the plutocrats, the wealthy, the top 1%, and basically very tightly tied to the Tea Party, I suppose. We've been discussing, this struggle for the soul of the Tea Party. Are they going to go more in the direction of Eisenhower and become rational again, or even Nixon, setting aside his criminal tendencies, or, which, I don't know, maybe just part of the Republican soul, or are they going to go full-on Ron Paul Tea Party crazy? And although Rand Paul right now and Mitch McConnell are both asking Kentucky to get $8 billion in federal money to help dredge a river there. So there's this movement over at Democratic Underground to send them shovels so they can do it themselves. Hey, we don't need no stinking government. You guys can go down and dig it yourself. But anyhow, what would happen to America? What would America be like if the entire Republican Party, top to bottom, really went full-on Tea Party? I think it would be crazy.
Yeah, I don't know if it's really that much of a hypothetical. I mean, they might already be completely taken over. I mean, at least in the House of Representatives, the Tea Party dictates the agenda there. At least they did for the last 2 years in the House. And we've had this discussion before, whereas when Democrats take over, they kind of try and bring everybody in. And, when the Blue Dogs were in with the Democrats in the 111th Congress when President Obama first took over, there was a lot of disagreement about Obamacare. And it wasn't the progressives that took over and demanded the public option and shaped that bill. It was really Blue Dogs, Democrats, and moderates that shaped that bill. Whereas in the Republican House now, you really do have the radicals taking over and dictating the agenda. So when it comes to what will America look like if the Republican Party goes Tea Party, I think it'll look a lot like Paul Ryan's budget, which passed out of the House.
Right.
You know, you'll see
twice.
Yeah, passed twice, with Medicare basically being voucherized. Well, being voucherized, not basically. And although Social Security wasn't handed off to Wall Street in the budget, Paul Ryan has come out and said that he supports plans like that. And, you know, major tax, more tax cuts for the wealthy and everything like that. And just a
So does that mean that since all of these positions are so far out of the mainstream of America, outside of that small niche of people who watch Fox News and the Republican base, that the Republican Party could go the way of the Whigs? I mean, this is, you know, still my beating heart, but or calm, I guess. That's still.
To me, the Tea Party, there's two different aspects of it. There's the people leading it,
right,
who know exactly what they're doing, who know that they're advancing an agenda to benefit the very wealthy.
The Dick Armies, the David Crooks.
Yeah, at the expense of 99% of the country. And then there's this army of low-information voters who really don't know what they're getting involved in, but they know that they're upset with the government, as they should be, and know that their economic situation has deteriorated considerably over the last 30 years, and they don't know why.
Right.
They've been hijacked by these overlords, Dick Armey and the Koch brothers and the rest of them. But if you ask them individually, you know, keep your government hands off my Medicare. You know, they support Medicare. They support Social Security. They support wealthy people paying their fair share of taxes.
The individuals at the grassroots.
Right, the individuals.
But not the politicians who are taking the money from the billionaires, and certainly not the billionaires who will never need Social Security.
The entire Tea Party movement hinges on a large population of low-information voters. And once the Tea Party now has power, and if they were to gain even more power and be able to really enact, if Paul Ryan's budget were to be able to get passed out of the House, passed in the Senate and signed by a President Mitt Romney or something, then you would see a backlash from these low information voters when they realize they finally have been duped. Maybe. I mean, hopefully you would see that.
Or I think they'd figure out a way to blame it on Democrats. I mean, this is the thing that astounds me, is that, you know, what Republicans do is bad policy. And then when the consequence, you know, 32 years of Reaganomics, what has it done? It's wiped out the American middle class. Right now in Michigan, Governor Snyder is pushing right to work for less laws. The Michigan House and Senate both voted for them yesterday, and he's going to sign this thing.
Getting pushed by the Koch brothers, American for Prosperity. You know,
exactly, Americans for Prosperity and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. And, I mean, you've got protesters in Lansing right now. You've got people protesting this. They were yelling shame, shame, shame from the galleries in the House and Senate when these votes were taken. But, you know, they did it. And the vast majority of people would like to have the right to unionize. But Michigan is going to join Mississippi and Indiana, which did, you know, it's now moving into the Rust Belt.
Yeah,
right?
That's the real important factor here is, if you look at the right to work states, the vast majority of them are in the South and out in the Midwest and everything. And especially in the South, I mean, these were the slave states.
Which is the right to work for less.
Yeah, for a lot less. So, and the fact that these states now in the manufacturing belt and everything like that in the United States are going right to work is very troubling.
Yeah, I agree. So, anyhow, what can be done? I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be – we live in very interesting times. I am fascinated by all this. Richard in Glendale Heights, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Richard, welcome to the program. What you wanted to talk about ALEC?
Right. Bill Moyers had – thank you for taking my call, by the way.
Sure.
But Bill Moyers had a program on TV last weekend about ALEC, and I didn't even know there was such an organization. It's a not-for-profit organization. And I think they've contributed to the problems that we've had in Indiana and Wisconsin and Michigan to get these laws passed.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm with you. And ALEC, by the way, here is a short clip. Thank you for the call, Richard. Here is a short clip from the man who was one of the co-founders of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, back in the 1980s. This was him in 1980 speaking to a group of Republican activists in a church in Dallas, Texas. By the way, he was helping run the Reagan campaign at that time. He worked on both Bush campaigns. Longtime Republican strategist. He was one of the co-founders of the Heritage Foundation, where Jim DeMint is going, as well as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Here's what he had to say.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Yeah, there you go. So it's like voter suppression. He's gung-ho for voter suppression. And surprise, Sam, where did the voter suppression laws come from?
From Alec. And this speaks to the point you're making, too, about what America looks like if the Tea Party takes over. Smaller government, somebody has to fill that vacuum, and that becomes corporate power. And Alec is the prime example of corporate power writing our laws, you know, dictating our government.
Yeah, the American legislature. Alec is where, and in fact, they're having a big meeting right now, aren't they? It's right around this time. I saw a notice of it that where you know they get together and it's like one on one. You get a corporate lobbyist and a Republican state legislator, and they get hundreds of them together, hundreds of these state legislators from all over the country. And
the funny thing is, we hear about secret government like Bilderberg and things like that. This is happening right out in the open. This is the corporatocracy at work, right out in the open.
Except it hasn't been out in the open until the last
until
year. I mean, this was done virtually in secret for 30 years. And thanks to Lee Fong, in large part, who writes for The Nation
now.
He
got beat up trying to infiltrate meetings.
Yeah, actually, you're right. Yeah. He was bloody. 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with more of Anything Goes Friday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And check out our new iPhone and iPad apps over at the App Store. It's free and it's fun, and you can read my daily take on it. All kinds of cool stuff. Sam, welcome. Sam Sachs for the studio. Shano, the king of bumpers.
Shano.
Indeed. Bill in Laconia, New Hampshire. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. You wanted to talk about the post office.
Yeah, Tom. I just thought a lot was getting lost in this argument regarding funding of the Postal Service. Because my understanding was that the Postal Service was originally designed just to have an informed electorate.
No, it was also designed to facilitate commerce.
Yeah, and they basically they subsidized the delivery of newspapers, so it was very inexpensive to get the information out.
Right.
And I don't think it was really designed to make money. It was actually an obligation of our government to provide information to the people as well.
Well, it's,
and that it was looked at as a cost, not a a money-making venture. I mean, they're not made to compete with UPS or FedEx. Or,
yeah, and in fact, this is why we have roads, by the way. The powers granted to Congress, Section 8 of Article 1, to establish post offices and post roads. So the post office was considered pretty important stuff, but, you know, it got privatized. I'm not sure exactly when. Semi-privatized.
I think in the 70s it was separated.
So this was one of Jimmy Carter's brilliant ideas.
It might have been before Carter.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure.
I have to look that one up.
With the post office, there's very easy solutions for the post office when it comes down to it. They have to pay $5 billion a year, which no other business or government agency has to do to pre-fund retiree benefits 75 years out in the future where people aren't even born yet. You get rid of that burden, and you also give the post office about they've overpaid about $75 billion in retiree pensions to the Treasury Department. They can get some of that money back. They'll be fine.
Or if they just stop paying into it. I mean, the thing that really blew my mind was that in 2006, the year that the Republicans pushed this thing through, this mandate through.
Postal Enhancement and Accountability Act.
Right, yeah. Great memory. That when they did that I remember that year, or perhaps it was the year before, the post office was seriously looking at converting a large part of their fleet into electric vehicles. I mean, they were like, this could be the thing that will be the way that when occasionally we'll have a war or something, and then there's a, you know, because of the demand for military technology, there are leaps that happen, like night goggles and Velcro. Well, Velcro came out of NASA. But, you know, we're government spending programs leapfrog technology as a consequence of just the demand. And the Postal Service is the largest fleet of vehicles, privately owned or independently, you know, one group of vehicles in the nation, one of the largest fleets in the world. And if they were to take 20-30% of those cars, which travel fewer than 100 miles a day, and turn them into electric vehicles, it would have been a huge thing. And then all of a sudden the Republicans come along and say, and the post office was profitable enough to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, they actually had the money. This was a serious proposal. And the Republicans came along and said, no, we're going to kneecap the post office.
I mean, that and about 500,000 postal workers who belong to various sorts of unions too.
Yes, let us not forget the largest union, the largest employer in the United States is Walmart, which is not unionized. The second largest employer in the United States is the post office, which is unionized. And that means, A, many of them vote for Democrats, B, they provide shoe leather for the Democratic Party, and therefore the Republicans want to take them out and as quickly and as aggressively as possible. So we'll see where that goes. Bill in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Hey, Bill, you wanted to talk about foreign aid?
Yes, I did. I'm a blind disabled veteran, and I hear all these programs that are on the table, Social Security and, you know, the veterans issue and everything. But something I never hear about is, do we still even have a foreign aid policy, and why is
yes.
that not being looked into?
Well, we do. It's not a large amount of money. I think the largest single recipients of our foreign aid are Egypt and Israel, and they both get in the neighborhood of around $3 billion. I think Egypt gets about $3 billion a year, and Israel gets around $4 billion, which is not, in the grand scheme of things, a large amount of money. In terms of foreign aid...
That's more than pocket change, but...
There's
so many other smaller countries. The last I even heard about it was many years ago. We were giving millions of dollars to Uruguay, which at the time was a communist country. And my question is, why isn't it being looked at? And is it that necessary?
Well, I think good question, Bill. I think it's an important time for our entire nation to have a conversation about foreign aid. Why are we doing it? What are the goals? If you look at foreign assistance, if you look at actually helping other countries solve problems, Japan on a per capita basis, I think is number one in the world in terms of foreign aid, and we're relatively low on that on a per capita basis. If you look in gross numbers, we're much higher, but Japan, Norway, Sweden, there's a bunch of these European countries or these social democracies that are doing much better than us. But then on the other hand, you've got there's a lot of self-interest. The Japanese investments in foreign aid typically will go to a country and they'll say, yes, we'll build that road if you use Japanese suppliers to build it. And the Chinese are doing this in many countries. Your thoughts on this, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, I think foreign aid plays an important part of what we want to be in the world. And unfortunately, I think a lot of our foreign aid that goes to good causes is overshadowed by a lot of our military misadventure in a lot of the same areas. I forgot the guy's name who advocates building schools instead of around the area.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
But when you have a foreign policy based more on drone warfare, then our foreign aid can only go so far.
Yeah, Three Cups of Tea was his book. I can't remember his name either, but. Greg Mortensen. Greg Mortensen. Yep. And so if our foreign aid, I think frankly, if we were to say, okay, what's one of the biggest problems in the world right now? The environment's melting down. Why is the environment melting down? 7 billion human beings. What do we do about that? We stabilize population. How do you stabilize population? You empower women. And so if we were building schools all around the world for women, In the third world.
It sounds like you're pushing one of those one world UN government forces.
No, do it as foreign aid for the
United
States.
Sounds like Agenda 21.
Let us be the one world government. It's Anything Goes Friday. Sam Sachs with us. He's going to hang out for a little bit longer, and we'll continue taking your calls on pretty much anything you want to talk about, although we've got a couple things on our list, too, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday. By the way, you can drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com. It's free. It's fun.
And I'm a one-girl revolution. I'm a one-girl revolution.
Well, yeah, I think that McKenna Pope actually is a one-girl revolution, whatever it was. Was just said, McKenna Pope is a Garfield, New Jersey eighth grader who has done something really quite extraordinary. McKenna, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's awesome to be on it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you with us. So tell us about this petition that you put up over at the at President Obama's website, change.org. It's at change.org/easybake. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, I started the petition. The petition is basically, I'm petitioning Hasbro to include nails on the packaging in their promotional materials for the Easy Bake Oven product, and also to feature the product in less gender-neutral colors, because it currently only comes in pink and purple, and that color is very, you know, gender-specific to girls.
Yeah, and I don't remember how it came about, but I am one of four boys, and I remember when I was a little kid, you know, 6, 8, something like that, we had an Easy Bake Oven in my house. We had one, you know, it had a little light bulb in it, and I remember baking something with my mom in that. Maybe mom bought it for us, but it didn't seem like it was all frilly and pink. Maybe they came in like browns back then or something. But you're suggesting that this, and there's a reason why you came up with this idea. What was that?
Well, I really came up with this idea because of my brother. My brother, he's 4 years old, and he loves to cook. You know, he really wants to be a chef when he grows up. So I always find him cooking. You know, even one time I walked into his room and saw him trying to cook tortillas on top of his light bulb, which was the craziest thing. But so when I saw him doing that, and then around Christmas time when he started asking for an Easy Bake Oven, you know, from Santa, we figured it would be the perfect idea. But when I went with my parents to go buy it for him from Target, we were disappointed to find that there was only girls in the boxes and, you know, in the commercials, and that it only came in pink and purple.
So McKenna, it seems like it would be in the best interest of Easy Bake Oven, too, if they broaden their marketing out to boys, too. I mean, wouldn't they be able to sell a lot more Easy Bake Ovens as well?
Oh, we lost McKenna.
I hope I didn't offend her.
Her phone line literally fell off the... Yeah, it went and she's gone. Must have been on a cell phone. So well, in any case, I think what McKenna is doing is great. And, you know, it's like trying to break down some of these fairly rigid gender lines. I'm old enough to remember when the Help Wanted ads in the paper used to be men wanted and women wanted. And, you know, we broke that one down. Now, you know, some others. McKenna Pope, you're back with us?
Yes, I'm sorry. My phone hung up.
That's quite all right. We just have a couple more, another minute or so. In any case, what kind of response have you gotten, and have you gotten any blowback from this? Have you gotten any angry response, or is it mostly supportive response? How is this being taken?
Angry responses from, like, just people in general or from Hasbro?
Well, any of the above. I'm curious what, you know, here you are, an eighth grader who has come out with this very public suggestion, and you know, what kind of feedback have you gotten?
Yeah, well, quite a few people, you know, a lot of articles and such have been written about me and what I'm doing, and I'm finding that a lot of people don't think that I started this petition myself. They think that my mom is using me to push her political propaganda, which I find completely hilarious because she's not the type of person who would do that. I really did think of this, you know, on my own, and there have been a lot of people who say that I'm overreacting and that what I'm doing, I should just leave it alone, but those are the types of people that are only making me want to push this further and want to do it even more.
That is great, McKenna. You are an activist. I am so impressed. Thank you so much for coming on the program. By the way, have you gotten a response from Hasbro yet?
I have, actually. They responded to me with, I guess, a pretty disappointing response. They told me that they have featured males recently in their packaging promotional materials, which is completely untrue. At least in their particular products that I'm petitioning, the Easy Bake Ultimate Oven, which is supposedly like their best product yet, you know, and they told me that in this 2009 Baker of the Year contest that they held, a boy was the finalist in that. And basically their entire response just really told me that boys play with their product. But the funny thing about that is that I know boys play with their products, so that's why I'm just, like, wondering why are they only marketing it to girls if they are aware that boys like and enjoy their products.
Right. There you go. Okay. McKenna Pope, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for your activism. I honor it. You are an extraordinary young woman. And just once again, the website is change.org/easybake, all one word, all run together, all lowercase. Thank you, McKenna.
Thank you.
This is absolutely extraordinary. It's
when I was little, there were Easy Bake ovens for boys, but it was they were called creepy crawlers or something. You would fill this mold and you would put it in the oven and it would come out in like spiders and worms and things like that.
Oh, really?
So I guess that's what they assumed. You couldn't eat it. At least I don't remember.
So it was like for clay. It was like
it was some kind of like gel mold that you baked in this little oven, but it was to put all over your house and scare your mom or whatever with worms.
Maybe those are still around. Six toys that could make progressives' head explode. This is over at Alternate. There's a McDonald's McJob playset. Hey, you wanna grow up to be a cashier at McDonald's? It's pretty much all that's left, right? You know, because of
hard to get a job there even.
32 years of insane trade policy. Yeah, you're right. You know, the author of this piece, Lauren Kelly, she says this is offensive because low wage McJobs, like ringing out customers at McDonald's, are becoming some of the few options available for American workers. The Easy Bake Oven, this is the one that McKenna Pope is talking about. Makeup for babies, My Pretty Learning Purse, this is like literally to put on your baby or your toddler. Slurpee Maker, yes, if you don't want to work at McDonald's, you can work at 7-Eleven, and you can make Slurpees. Let's kids pretend to be low-wage workers. Fun.
Does it include a strike sign nowadays?
there's an opportunity for you, Sam.
Develop a business. Market your own strike signs for low-wage workers.
Yeah.
Kids
who aspire to be low-wage strikers.
Yeah.
And then Legos for girls, another one. This is interesting. Okay, so let's get back to Anything Goes Friday here and pick up some more calls. Alex in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Alex. Thanks for calling. You wanted to it says you're a firefighter.
Yeah, I'm a firefighter, paramedic. I work in Salinas, California, mm-hmm. which is a city of about 150 to 200,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And the city itself is like a diamond, and the Freeway 101 goes right in the middle of it. And I guess I'm responding to earlier in the week, you were debating a woman about the government role in stopping and preventing obesity with high fructose corn syrup. And she was saying that that's an individual choice, it's parents' responsibility. Well, that same day when I was at work, after hearing that, I remember talking to a 30-year veteran captain who's retiring in 3 weeks. And we were comparing the kinds of traumatic car accidents that we go on now with those that he went on in the early and mid 80s and into the 90s. And he said, you don't see the kind of accidents, traumatic head injuries that you saw earlier in his career. He would go on calls where the parents would totally survive, and the toddlers that were unrestrained in the back seat were, you know, found under the seats, totally mangled and dead.
Right.
And totally preventable. And you don't see those kinds of accidents anymore. And the reason why is because of government intervention, seatbelt requirement laws. And
I remember when I was a little kid, there was an acquaintance of mine. He was 17. I was probably 10. And up in northern Michigan. And he had just gotten his driver's license. This would have been in the 50s. And he hit a tree, and the steering wheel went right through his chest. I mean, took him out. And I didn't see it, but everybody in town knew the story, and that wouldn't have happened today. There would have been an airbag and there would have been a seatbelt. We didn't have seatbelts in cars back then, and they certainly didn't have airbags. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and so the point is that her argument is not only naive, but it's just empirically wrong with common sense and what we see as first responders this day.
Right. So as a first responder, you're seeing the positive consequence of government regulation. At least with regard to safety in vehicles.
Exactly. Now, if the government could actually make those cars safer for firefighters who are responding to the trapped patients who are in those mangled cars, because what they've done is they've made all these requirements and safety. The auto industry has made all these requirements for airbags and seat belts and the way the power or the energy is transmitted in the mangling parts, that works outside of the actual seating area of the patients.
Right, the frame taking the shot.
Now all those things are very dangerous to firefighters, and dozens of firefighters have to retire early because of traumatic incidents while we're responding to those patients. So yeah,
wow.
My point is that government can work to in the interest of people, and that person is really naive that you were debating.
Okay, Alex, thanks for sharing your truth, your story with us. I appreciate it. It's very. Yeah, it's a very good story to hear. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Sam is going to join us and answer a few questions as well. We'll be taking your calls here. Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Do you aspire to be a McDonald's worker when you grow up? Yes, you too can have a McDonald's cash register toy. Seriously. The news. Let's check out the news of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria Jones, brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Help give a goat. You can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person that you helped. For that information, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Victoria, hang on just a minute. It helps if I push the right button. Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Great to see you. Sam Sachs is here with me, too. He may pop in with a question from time to time. So what's going on in the world of news today? What's going on in the world today?
There's plenty today. Very interesting stuff. The Supreme Court announced today that it will take up California's ban on same-sex marriage. This is the case that could actually give the justices a chance to rule on whether gay Americans have the same constitutional right to marry as heterosexuals. They also said today that they will review a federal appeals court ruling that struck down the state's gay marriage ban, though on narrow grounds. They said that they will also decide whether Congress can deprive legally married gay couples of federal benefits otherwise available to married people. A provision of the Defense of Marriage Act limits a range of health and pension benefits as well as favorable tax treatment to heterosexual couples. They're expecting the cases to be argued late March with a decision probably late June. I would expect it'll be one of the last decisions we'll get.
Wow. Now, the decision that ratified slavery, the Supreme Court decision in 1856, Dred Scott, the Chief Justice of the court thought, I mean, there was all this conflict around slavery. He thought by simply saying, okay, we're going to make a decision, slavery is okay, that he would put the issue to rest. And, of course, arguably Dred Scott led right to the Civil War. Is there any indication which way this court might go? And is it possible? I mean, Scalia has come out and said he doesn't think that there's a right to gay marriage in the Constitution.
No indication at all that I've heard of which way they're likely to go, no.
And I'm wondering if they were to affirm DOMA, I suppose that simply means that it could be legislated around. They're not making a case against gay marriage. They'd be making a case against a law. But, you know, might that be like Dred Scott, something that produces basically a revolution in America?
Well, the DOMA case is particularly interesting because, of course, that one is about benefits. And on the DOMA question, four federal district courts and two appeals courts have already struck down the provision, basically saying that you can't receive these benefits.
Right. So in other
that's
words,
that's an interesting one.
In other words, those courts have agreed that gay marriage is okay, or they've disagreed with gay marriage.
They have agreed, as far as I can see, that that gay marriage is okay.
Okay, very interesting.
It's a very interesting one. Now, it's not clear to me because the stories are just starting to come out whether Elena Kagan might recuse herself from one of these cases, particularly the DOMA one, because depending which case it is that they've taken, and they've taken an interesting one of an 83-year-old woman who sued to challenge a $363,000 estate tax bill after her partner of 44 years died, whether she was in the administration and might have worked on that.
Very interesting. So what else is up?
I don't think she did. Things in Egypt continue to devolve. Mohamed El-Baradei, leader of the opposition, is urging calm and gave a brief speech saying that opposition protesters are not being driven by foreign conspirators or opposition leaders, but by genuine frustration. But I think the most interesting news today is that top army officials are reportedly meeting to discuss the situation in the streets, although a military source later denied the meeting was taking place, according to one news source.
It's top Egyptian army.
Top Egyptian army officials. Now, the Egyptian army has so far remained neutral in this.
And they're the real power in that country. This is something I think most Americans miss. They own most of the major industries. They are the military. They basically control the police. And the battle for control of the army or for the army's control of the government is one of the more interesting pieces of subtext to this whole thing.
Right. So it'd be very interesting to see if they decide to take a side or which way they decide to jump on this, if they decide to jump at all. And so far, of course, the police have not really intervened either. They've stayed neutral. The only people with guns who've been involved have been the sort of presidential guard, which is loyal to the president, which is separate from both the police and the army.
Interesting. Sort of the equivalent of the Secret Service.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So what else is up?
The U.S. military is facing fresh questions over its targeting policy in Afghanistan. A senior army officer told the Marine Corps Times that troops were on the lookout for, quote, children with potential hostile intent.
Children.
Legal experts and campaigners described the remarks as deeply troubling. Lieutenant Colonel Marion Carrington told the Marine Corps Times that children as well as military-aged males have been identified as a potential threat because some were being used by the Taliban. He said, it kind of opens our aperture.
Man, this reminds me of the Korean War. I mean, you know, so many U.S. GIs came back from the Korean War telling these horror stories of women in particular who would march toward American soldiers and then raise their hands, and when they got very close to the American soldiers, they would raise their hands and drop grenades that would take them out and take the soldiers out. And it turned out that there was people behind them with guns pointed at them that, you know, they basically had to do this. And so then when people started trying to surrender to American forces, this having happened, American GIs would just mow them down. And a lot of GIs came back with just god-awful post-traumatic stress, injury as a consequence of that. I mean, is that the kind of direction that we could be going in Afghanistan?
Kids? Well, that is the concern. That is very much the concern of the Center for Constitutional Rights, specialists in targeted killings. They say they're concerned over what to seem to be an attempt to justify the killing of children. There are two people quoted in this story, one unnamed Marine Corps official who questioned the, quote, innocence, unquote, of Afghan children. So it does
incredible.
Seem to be that there's a danger of moving in that direction.
George W. Bush opened the gates of hell when he started these two wars. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
And don't forget, Talk Radio News Service's report every day is brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of the war in South Sudan.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program, Anything Goes Friday. Sam has left the building. It's just me, which, it's kind of cool. Don in Harrington, Delaware. Hey, Don, thanks for listening to Sirius. It says you might disagree with me.
Well, did I hear you correctly saying that when the guy was calling about succeeding, that you were comparing it to Scotland and that Scotland shouldn't leave the U.K.?
No, I'm not sure what you heard. I did mention Scotland, or perhaps the secessionist that we were talking with mentioned Scotland. I don't represent myself as an expert on British politics. It does seem to me that Scotland, I've been to Scotland a number of times. I've been to the UK a lot of times, and it seems my experience of it is that Scotland has historically had their own identity as their own country. And they now have their own parliament. They are semi-autonomous, and this was a big step that was taken a couple of years back. And, should they want to become entirely autonomous, and maybe they are now. I frankly...
No, they're not. They're going to take a vote in 2014, which the Tories in Westminster are trying to scare the people, the older people, that they're going to lose their pensions. But they had the same problem that the blue states have, that for every pound or dollar that they send to London, they're getting back 80 cents, and they don't have full representation, and that you have one Tory MP in Scotland, and they basically get shafted by the English.
Yeah, but see, to the extent that I would have a discussion of Scottish autonomy and independence in the same paragraph or conversation as a conversation about southern states or any state in the United States wanting to secede from the Union, I don't think that there is a reasonable parallel there. Scotland has been an independent nation for hundreds, maybe thousands of years at various times, and the southern states of the United States were an independent nation for, I don't know how long the Civil War was fought, what, a couple of years?
Right.
So, you know, 3 years and change. It doesn't seem, in my mind, now, the secessionist was yesterday saying that, and I'm sorry, I forget his name, but he was saying that the south of the Mason-Dixon line extended all the way down to Brazil. In other words, everybody was using slave labor. Say that again, sir. Oh, Michael Cushman was his name, yeah. Anyhow, he was saying that, that this was all one giant, empire of slave owners, and therefore it was a separate country. I don't buy that argument.
Well, Scotland's going to have their vote in 2014. They're trying to allow 16 and 17-year-olds to vote, and they're doing it on the 700th anniversary of Bannockburn, which was a battle that they beat the English.
Right. Okay.
Well, it should be a really good party over there.
Yeah, it should be. It should be very interesting to see how that all plays out. Don, thank you very much for the call. Debbie in San Jose, California, NDAA.
Yeah. Basically, I wanted to talk about the NDAA and other acts that have been passed, like the Patriot Act and its renewal. Every time each of these kind of things or these laws are passed, I'm afraid that the relationship between the government and the people changes to that of one of the government being in fear of the people for, bad things happening to them when they pass such unconstitutional laws, to being that of the people being in fear of the government. And there just hasn't hardly been even a whimper from anybody. The fact that the NDAA passed 98-0 is really chilling.
Yeah. I don't disagree, although most of the NDAA is simply the military appropriation. It's, the Constitution says that no appropriation for the Army, for the military, other than the Navy, can last more than 2 years. And so, every year or every 2 years at the very most, Congress has to reappropriate money for the Pentagon. But attached to it for the last couple of years has been this piece that says that American citizens can be held indefinitely and prosecuted in military courts. If the military in their infinite wisdom, or if the president in his infinite wisdom, decides that they are engaging in terrorist activity. And, one of the things that I think Americans need to remember, and most Americans don't have this experience, but anybody who's lived in a third world dictatorship can tell you all about it, is that the typical way that a dictatorial power operates is not the vision that we have of the Nazi stormtroopers marching into town and separating out all the people with a certain kind of name or ancestry or color of skin or whatever and taking them off and shooting them. That's actually fairly rare. The typical way that an autocratic repressive regime works is they pass relatively innocuous laws, and a lot of them, that say that, for example, in China, if you move from your hometown, if you go anyplace else outside of your hometown, you have to have the permission of the local police. If you don't, you've broken the law. About a third of the entire country has moved, and virtually none of them have permission. So if the government then decides that they want to come down on you, if you've created laws that cause pretty much everybody in the country to be a lawbreaker, and you want to step on dissent or you want to step on a group of people, You use those laws. Everybody's a lawbreaker, so now you come down on them. And the NDAA is a camel's nose under the tent of that sort of thing, in my opinion.
That's right.
And I'm frankly very concerned about it. Debbie, thank you for raising the topic. It needs to be raised more often. Joe in Toledo, Ohio. Your father's a conservative.
Yes. Hello?
Hello. Is it Joe?
Yes.
In Toledo. Okay.
Yes.
Hi, Joe.
So, hi.
So you called to talk about your dad being a conservative? Do I have that right?
Yeah, but that's not, but he's extremely conservative,
mm-hmm.
and I am not. I'm a bleeding heart liberal, and I know that just eats him alive. But my concern is my dad has just survived leukemia.
Ouch. That's a tough one.
I know. No, it's wonderful because he was able to get the drug Gleevec, which is like the hero drug for leukemia. The problem is it costs a lot. It costs $6,400 a month.
Wow.
And his insurance, which I believe is Medicare, covers all but $2,000. So he pays $2,000 out of pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, his oncologist at the Mayo Clinic tells him that he better hope Obamacare doesn't go through, because if it does, they will not be able to give him Gleevec anymore. He said they told him that if you're over 78 or you're under 5, you might as well be thrown away.
Well, whoever told him that is wrong.
Is there any truth to this?
No, there's not.
Is there any truth to this? Because he believes every word they tell him, because they saved his life, of course.
Yeah. Apparently this is a doctor who's been watching Fox News. No,
sure.
there are no such guidelines. Those are the guidelines that Sarah Palin and her ilk have suggested must be coming along with Obamacare. We're going to have to start rationing care to people, particularly if they're old or young.
Right.
But no, there is no such provision in Obamacare. And in fact, the death panel, this group of 18 people who will oversee Obamacare and make sure that things are done appropriately, they, by law, do not have the authority to do those kinds of things. Anything that has to do with individual patients or patient care, their job is to make sure that the pharmaceutical companies aren't ripping off the country, or that the big hospital chains aren't ripping off the country. So basically, you've got a right-wing crank for a doctor who watches Fox News.
Well, and see, I'm a nurse. I work with doctors, and a lot of them talk the same stuff.
Oh,
you know, you better hope you're not on Medicare next year, because if you are, we're not going to be able to see so many Medicare patients.
Yeah.
But how can I, Tom, how can I find this information and prove it to my mom and dad? My mother is just absolutely sick.
Yeah,
she had to go to bed when Obama was reelected. She's scared to death that my dad's going to die. They told him if he doesn't have Gleevec, they give him 5 years to live.
Okay, here's where you want to go. Go to healthcare.gov, healthcare.gov. And this is the official website that explains everything about Obamacare and all the health care provisions that the government has and will have. And you will be able to find your answers there, Joe. Okay?
Thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Healthcare.gov. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
NurseUnited.org also has a lot of information on this, and I would suggest that you get in touch with them. It's a great group. NurseUnited.org.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows anything goes.
Anything goes. Tom and the Dalai Lama, Jim says. Okay. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 20 minutes past. That was an amazing trip. They actually made a movie out of that. It's called Dalai Lama Renaissance, narrated by Harrison Ford. Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ed, anything goes Friday. You wanted to talk about the minimum wage?
Yeah, sort of, kind of. I want to talk about the fiscal cliff.
All right.
And the president, he could issue an executive order right before we go off that fiscal cliff that minimum wage would be $14.50 an hour from now on.
Yeah, well, he could. He could, although...
Hey, Tom.
Yeah.
Can I finish the idea first, buddy?
Sure. Go for it.
Okay. We'll all work a six-hour day, 6 hours straight time, 14-15 hour or whatever, and after that, it's time and a half. We'll all work a 30-hour week. That will be a full-time job. This will create 10 to 20, 40 million jobs.
Yeah, the French did that.
Yeah. And so companies will pay a 39% tax on all their profit, but... because of this new rule, they'll get a 15, maybe 17% discount on their taxes they employ if they have more than 5 employees.
Okay. Why do we want to incentivize companies to hire people when they will hire them anyway if there's demand for their products? Why give them a tax break for it?
Here's the thing. because they have to pay $14.50 an hour now. So if you have a pizza shop and you normally have four people in the building, you're going to hire to five to six people in order to, you have to have more than five employees because that discount.
Yeah, okay, well, so in 1960, here, companies were paying the equivalent in today's dollars of around $10.50 an hour as minimum wage. And most companies were right. paying a little over minimum wage. So I just think that we should say this is the floor for a civilized society in terms of income. You know, and raise the minimum wage to $10, $11, $12 an hour, and just say that's it. And if you can't make a business model work with that as a minimum wage, then you know, move to Mexico. But it's like, you know, pretty straightforward stuff. Excellent point, Ed. Thank you very much for the call, Steve in Utica, Michigan. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Tom, hello. I wanted to talk taxes. So I'll start here. I heard a clip from Joe Biden talking about the 2% and saying how 120,000 families are going to benefit from the Republicans not raising taxes. Tom, that, first of all, that 2% doesn't exist because the 250,000, the IRS doesn't even measure a bracket of 250,000. When you look at the statistics of income measured by the IRS, they start at 200,000. So it's more like 5%. And there's 4 million tax returns, not 120,000. 80% of those tax returns have incomes less than $500,000.
Yeah, in the top 2%, certainly.
And 500,000.
Yeah. The top 1% is incomes over 360,000, I think, a year. The top 2% would be incomes over, what, 220-something? It's been a while since I've seen the numbers.
3.2 million returns,
right.
80%. Are between 200 and 500,000.
Right.
So there's about 800,000 returns. Excuse me. Yeah, 800,000 returns. So about a very small percentage that's even over 500,000. People making 500,000 a year don't have villas in Italy. They're not driving Bentleys. They don't have servants. But this is how this issue is being presented, and that's why you lose people like me, where I get furious. I'm also a business owner. And I make more than the average guy, but I don't have servants. I don't own a mansion.
You realize Joe Biden is not suggesting that any taxes should go up on the first $250,000 you earn.
I understand that, Tom.
And only after the $250,000, then on those additional dollars does your tax go up.
Completely.
Do you think it should be at a half million or a million?
It certainly shouldn't be at $250,000. And I think probably, you know, and I probably would get shot if I said this around my fellow partners in our firm, but I'd say over $1 million.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have a problem. We have lots of clients that make a lot of money. And if they, you know, you're making $1 million a year, okay, I think you should be willing to pay some more. But unfortunately, that's not how the issue was presented.
No, I don't disagree with you. And this is where, frankly, I think that we should go back to the tax code we had before Reagan came along, which was basically your first $1 million, you know, you paid fairly low taxes on. And after that, it went up to 74%. And so you had a situation. I don't know if you're old enough to have ever seen the old sitcom I Dream of Jeannie.
Sure, absolutely,
okay.
Larry Hagman.
Yeah, Larry Hagman. It comes to mind because he recently died, and
Yeah.
Remember how the boss, the guy who owned the company, always used to come over to his house?
Right.
He'd bang on the door and come running in because he lived right down the street.
Yep.
Back in that day, when that movie was made or when that TV show was made back in the 70s, pre-Reagan, bosses were making 10, 20, maybe 30 times what their employees were making. Not 300, 400, 500 times. The boss lived down the street. The companies were small. Reagan hadn't stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act yet. Businesses were not these giant conglomerates. We didn't have billionaires and trillionaires. I don't totally disagree with you, Steve. I think that if we took the top tax rate back to 74% where it was, and on above that, I mean, it was a 91% in 1960, and all the way back to 1944. If we took it up to that level and the threshold was $1 million, which I think should be enough for anybody to live on in the United States, I would agree with you.
Yeah, and we
have we reached a point of agreement?
We have, absolutely. And I'm assuming you assume that I'm Republican, which I am. But I'm reasonable.
Yeah, God bless you. The party needs more people like you.
We're not going to get anywhere unless everybody both sides. So I'll say, you know, Republicans got to concede on this issue. Democrats got to stop saying, you know, trying to put people that make 250 or 500 the same as Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And then maybe we'll get somewhere.
Well, and here's the big way to make the difference, Steve. And, you know, I don't disagree that you could raise that top rate to a half million or a million, and it would have very little consequence. But the other thing is, let's do away with the capital gains loophole. Are you with me on that?
I'm not so sure on that. We have to discuss that more, and I'll call you back another time.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. Which raises the question, why should a surgeon pay 35% income tax and a bankster pay 15%? I don't get it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the simple reason is that the bankster is making money through capital gains or dividends, and the surgeon is making money by actually working. Friday, Tom Hartman here with you. One of the great spectacles that happened yesterday, Mitch McConnell goes on to the floor of the Senate and says, okay, I got this bill here that I would like to introduce and have an up or down vote on that will do away with the debt ceiling debate in the future. From now on, instead of Congress deciding whether or not to raise the debt ceiling, the president can do it himself. Expecting that Harry Reid would say, oh, no, we're not going to have anything like that. We're not going to bring that. I'm not going to bring that to the floor for a vote. And Harry Reid said, okay, Senator, great. In 10 minutes, we'll have the debate and the vote. And all of a sudden, Mitch McConnell's like, wait a minute. I filibuster. And seriously, I'm not making this up. And Senator Dick Durbin then comes to the mic. The brilliant senator from Illinois comes to the mic and he says this. Listen to this.
So this may be a moment in Senate history when a senator made a proposal and when given an opportunity for a vote on that proposal, filibustered his own proposal. I think we have now reached a new spot in the history of the Senate we've never seen before. I'm going to ask the parliamentarian to really look into this. I don't think this has ever happened before, but it really calls into question whether or not this was the kind of offer that one would consider to be good faith.
Well, clearly it wasn't a good faith offer. This was Mitch McConnell. I mean, come on. This is the guy who right now is, along with Senator Rand Paul, asking the governor of Kentucky, this Associated Press, Dateline Frankfort, Kentucky, U.S. Senators Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul are urging Governor Steve Beshear to seek a federal disaster declaration because of the potential economic consequences of a drought, climate change, that has led to low water levels in the Mississippi River, climate change. And they're asking for federal money. We are informed that shipment of over $7 billion in goods in the Mississippi River could be blocked over the coming months due to this entirely avoidable event, they wrote, climate change. So Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, they want free money, are petitioning the governor of the state of Kentucky. They want billions of dollars, federal money. They're petitioning the governor of Kentucky, climate change, to declare emergency status so they're eligible for federal money so they can dredge this river because there's this drought going on. Oh, gee. But I thought they believed in self-reliance. I think, I'm not a libertarian, so I can't do this. But if any of our libertarian listeners, libertarian activist listeners are, you know, within the sound of my voice, as they say on radio and television, and would like to do it, I think it would be a really cool idea for a libertarian website or a libertarian publication to set up a program that will connect citizens in Kentucky who don't own shovels with citizens in the other states who do own shovels. Right? I've got a shovel. I would be glad to loan it to somebody in Kentucky for 3 or 4 months if they want to go out and dig the ditch or deepen the river. No problem. Probably have to, you know, hook up some people who have scuba diving equipment as well. But I'm guessing there's plenty of people in Kentucky who know how to operate underwater. You know, they can dig with their shovel underwater. But let's start with the shovels. Let's just hook up people in America who have shovels with people in Kentucky who don't, so that Senator Rand Paul and Senator Mitch McConnell can stop whining about needing federal dollars to dredge this river. It's totally bizarre. Bill O'Reilly, by the way, have you heard Bill O'Reilly has discovered who's responsible for the war on Christmas? Yeah, listen to this.
It has to do with, at the root of it, it has to do with two things, abortion and, the gay rights agenda, because Christianity is against those things. And that's, it's subtle, but that's why that's why it's so pronounced in these in recent years, in my opinion.
100% agree. I absolutely agree 100% that it's the diminishment of Christianity is the target, and Christmas is the vehicle, because the secularists know their opposition to their agenda. Legalized drugs is in that as well. Comes primarily from the Judeo-Christian traditionalist.
Right. So Christians never use drugs. I thought that was Mormons. You know, they don't drink tea or coffee. They don't drink alcohol. Or if Bill O'Reilly means illegal drugs, you know, define illegal in the state of Washington. but it's the gays who are running the war on Christmas. I'm telling you, these guys live in an alternative universe. There's just no other way to say it. Joe in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe, thanks for listening. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to mention with regard to the first responder who called earlier, I found an app on iPhone app called QRG for Quick Reference Guide. Mm-hmm. It's intended for first responders. It identifies vehicles and the safe method for first responders to rescue people from them.
So there's an app for that.
There's an app for that. He's correct that a better solution would be a consistent engineering process that would make entry into all vehicles similar, but until that happens, at least there's an app for that.
Right.
I came across the app. I'm not a first responder. I'm an educator. I teach classes in design and integrated marketing, and I was looking for examples for some class content, and I came across this as an app that is useful for information, not for selling things.
Right.
And as a design example, and so I used that in class, and I remembered it. I have it on my phone. So
yeah, what's the name of the app?
It's QRG for a quick reference guide.
Okay.
It's QRG.
Cool. Great. Joe, thanks for sharing that with us, and hopefully our first responder is still listening. Craig in Calabasas, California. You disagree with me about the fiscal cliff? Do I have that right?
I do, Tom. Actually, I just want to
What do you think is my position on the fiscal cliff?
Well, no, I was following up on the caller before the last caller, and I'm in his exact same situation financially in terms of the money that my wife and I make.
So you're making more than $250,000 and less than $1 million, and
we are. That's exactly right. And I wanted to ask you a question about it. By the way, in regards to the fiscal cliff, I want to make sure you know my position is this. I do not want us to go over the fiscal cliff, because I think it's going to be serious detriment to our economy. We're going to lose lots of jobs, which I don't want. However, I will say this, if we were to go over the fiscal cliff in regards to the raising of the taxes and the cuts that would be imposed, that may be the only way Washington can get anything done on both levels. So
I don't disagree with you. I frankly think we should go over it. And then Congress needs to get to work doing some, you know, minor repair work. But basically, all those Pentagon cuts will be easy. I mean, we're talking about not even going halfway to taking the Pentagon back to where it was when George Bush came into office in terms of its budget.
You and I totally agree on that.
And then on the domestic side, you know, those cuts are unspecified other than unemployment. And I would say immediately after the first of the year, Congress should you know, continue funding the unemployment compensation, because people are not unemployed by will. They're not choosing to be unemployed. And then the rest of the stuff, you know, let them have a debate about it. Let them work it out.
You and I totally agree on that. The place where we differ is, like I said, two callers ago, and it's a significant difference, because I have a question. In California, where I am, my wife and I, now granted, this is before we take our mortgage deduction and charitable deductions, but the coming year, the 2012 year, when my taxes are due, because there was a retroactive tax increase,
right,
for Prop 30 in California,
right,
our tax rate federal and state income taxes is going to hit 52% if everything goes through. That's if the federal rate goes to 39.6 and the state is already increased with a retroactive increase.
Right.
We do not make over $1 million.
But you
we
must be making
rich.
if that is true ultimately, yeah, on every dollar you earn. If what you're saying is that you're net.
It's not on every dollar, but
okay,
the effective rate actually probably comes in at 51%. It's probably 51%.
Well, then you've got to be earning enough to make up for the first, you know, 20,000-30,000 that is not taxed at all, and then the next, you know, 30,000 or 40,000 that's taxed at 10%, and the next 30,000 or 40,000
it goes to 11.
Right.
And it goes
right.
To
yeah.
Exactly
so
right.
So in order to make up for all that, you must be making a lot more on the high end. You must be making something like $700,000 or $800,000 a year.
You're right on the low end. You're absolutely correct.
Okay.
You're right on it. You're right on the number. And, you know, look, I'm not complaining about it, and I'm not whining about it. I just want people to understand that 7 in California becomes less than 350, and we live in a modest home, we drive modest cars, and we're trying to put money away for college like everybody else.
Yeah.
We're not rich. And two callers ago, we fall right into that same category.
You will recall, Craig, I didn't disagree with that guy.
I know you didn't. And what my point is, and I'm glad you didn't, and like I said, you and I are on the same page. And by the way, I am a Republican. Your last break, the NRA comments, your comments on Mitch McConnell, I agree with all of that.
Wow.
Guys like you
and that last caller need to take back your party, I'm telling you, because it's been taken over by crazies.
Well, I don't disagree with you there, but thanks for the time,
okay,
Tom.
You're welcome, Craig. Thanks for the call. And by the way, Craig, if people like Mitt Romney with his, you know, $20 million a year income, or people like Singer in New York City with his $2 billion a year income, we're not paying a 15% capital gains rate, you wouldn't have to be paying that 39% federal income tax rate. So, you know, consider it. Thanks a lot, Craig.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
See, I'm with Alan Grayson on this. A dollar is a dollar. Whether it's earned by a bankster or whether it's earned by a surgeon or whether it's earned by a small business person, a dollar is a dollar. It should all be taxed the same.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Well, you can tell we're getting close to Christmas, to the shortest days of the year here, when the capital of the country is dark at 5:50 p.m. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the various people at all the various companies that syndicate this program. We're one of the few shows that has multiple syndicators out there. Dow Global on commercial stations across the country, Pacifica Radio on nonprofit stations across the United States, Europe, and Africa, CRN Network on cable TV systems all over the country, the Free Speech TV Network on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and others around the country. Thanks to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Tamboli for our tech support, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you in particular for supporting our program. Thank you. It is truly appreciated. Bethany in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Bethany, you wanted to talk about Syria?
Yes. Oh, thank you so much for taking my call. I called against our proxy war in Libya as well, and I might as well add Mali because it's coming in January.
Oh, yeah.
And I just am so disappointed. What you said is so true about Free Speech TV. Everyone needs to know who Amber Lyons is. And consider the source of where this coming up, as well as look up CNN's report of the war with Iraq in 91.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say the same thing about WCPT. You're hearing on the progressive stations that carry our radio program.
A lot of A lot of hosts won't take my call if I say Syria or Libya, though. So it's
Okay, I am.
There's a line that we hold because we're one party, and so we get lobbyists from Monsanto and DuPont, and, you know, we're regulating our food. It's very frightening if we're going to talk
Bethany, let me ask you a question. I agree with your opposition to U.S. intervention in Syria and Libya and elsewhere, presumably. In the Congo, in the DRC, over 5 million people have died in that civil war now. In Rwanda, there was...
intervention that caused Rwanda. I mean, we really need to be honest.
In Rwanda, there was this horrible genocide, and the Clinton administration, you know, decided basically, we're not going to do anything, we're not going to intervene. At what point?
We had already intervened, though. It's all this trade that is causing these. I mean, look at Haiti and Mexico. Mm. He also caused genocide there through trade. Mm. I mean, there's such an evilness of just having one party. It's very frightening. Yeah. And I really wish you would look up the
children.
Okay.
Here's my question.
Children.
No, I get it, and I'm not disagreeing with you. My question is, and this is something I personally struggle with. I don't know the answer to this. I don't have a glib answer for this. But I'm curious your thoughts. If you look at the genocide that happened during World War II that Hitler was perpetrating across Europe of Jewish people, gays, ultimately Catholics, I mean, of on and on, trade unionists. If you look at the genocide that happened in Rwanda, at what point does the United States, or is there not a point, at what point does the United States have, at the very least, a moral obligation to say, we have the ability to stop this, therefore we're going to step in? I mean, it's sort of the Kitty Genovese question. You know, back in the 60s, Kitty Genovese was stabbed to death on a street in New York City as people walked by and she was screaming for help. At what point do we have an obligation to say, you know, we can do something to stop people from dying, therefore we should?
Well, at what point do we take responsibility? We have people dying in Mexico and Haiti, and we don't think twice. But it was Clinton and his policies that created that.
No, I get who you want to blame for all this stuff. And I'm not, as I said, I'm not disagreeing with you, Bethany. At what point do we intervene? Obviously, we need to change our own policies. Okay, I agree with you. We need to change our own policies, particularly our trade policies that, for example, are driving peasants off the land in Mexico. And that, you know, wiped out the sugar industry in Haiti, you know, with our subsidies for corn. I'm with you on that. But when horrible things are happening in another country, do you have a line that people would have to step over before or after you would say the U.S. should intervene?
Wow. I mean, we created these terrorists that we're sending there. This is a proxy.
Bethany, I got that. Okay. And again, I don't disagree with you. But this is, like I said, this is a question I don't have an answer for. Apparently, Bethany doesn't either. Maybe you know, and maybe this is a conversation that's just like, you know, too esoteric to even have. I don't know. I think it's an interesting question. Marge in Espanola, New Mexico. Hey, Marge, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to thank you for bringing on Richard Wolff a few weeks ago, talking about worker-owned businesses.
Yeah, we're going to get him back.
I wanted to add two subtopics to that.
But it has to be quick. We have 1 minute until the show's over.
Workplace democracy and group creative brainstorming, and that's just not happening in businesses. And I think that fills out a healthier workplace. I think they'd reduce the turnover and the illnesses in the workplace and enhance the workplace experience.
I agree. And do you know what democracy in a workplace in its simplest form in the United States is called? Is a union.
A union is a democratic institution.
Its members elect its leaders, and its members decide its policies. So it's democracy, and it's in the workplace. Now, I agree, you know, democratically owned workplaces are even better. You know, where you know, the business itself is owned by its employees or by its workers. I'm number one in favor of that. But lacking that, let's work for more unionization of the existing business in America as well. Marge, thank you for the call. Coming up next week, coming up Monday, I'll challenge Towson University student Matthew Heimbach, founder of the White Student Union. He says there's an inherent anti-white bias in academia and mainstream society. What? Plus, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag, you're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.